Kim, essentially what I wanted to do today was offer our listeners an overview of what has happened within Canada's prison institution in 2003, whether it's news that has impacted the lives of prisoners on the inside, their families on the outside, women, one of Canada's fastest growing prison populations, and some of the news that society in general should be concerned of.
Okay.
And I was wondering, perhaps in providing us this overview, we can focus on those different topics, but perhaps we can start with asking you to introduce yourself and your work with the Elizabeth Fry Societies.
Great. Yeah, my name is Kim Pate. I'm with the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. Our mandate is to work with and on behalf of when women aren't able to, for all kinds of reasons, most of which beyond their control, to be their own voice with their direction, assist them in speaking out. And so I've been working with young people, men and women, for the last 20 years in and around prisons, and consider myself a co-activist, an ally with those individuals who are struggling from the outside, or from the inside as well as from the outside.
And after 20 years of involvement within prisons, what stands out for you in terms of 2003?
Well, a couple of things that come to mind immediately are, I think, two things. One, I'm seeing not so much in prisons, but people in community seeming to be starting to wake up again to the fact that what's happening in our prisons is something they should be concerned about and is something that they are concerned about, particularly with respect to how what prisoners and those leaving prison are experiencing parallels much of what's happening in the community and exemplifies the worst that can happen if we don't take care of, whether it's the environment, the economy, all of those sorts of things. And by economy, I don't mean financial economy only. I mean the humanity in terms of investing in people and making sure that people have their basic entitlements, those sorts of things. So I think there's a growing concern. I wouldn't say there's action yet, but I think in 2003, I'm hoping we're seeing the beginning of a swing of more interest in social activism by many people who have become perhaps a bit complacent, or maybe it's their children because it's another generation becoming more interested, and I think that's important. In prisons themselves, the scariest thing I think I saw in 2003, and I know you didn't ask for the scariest, but the scariest I've seen is a whole move to, at the federal level, at the national level, to really regressive thinking about policies and practices within the prisons. Now, we always have known that abuses of power and abuses of authority and the brutality that then follows and generally flows from that exists in prison. We've known that for as long as the prisons have existed. In fact, it's been sanctioned in most prisons and in most prison environments. But at the level of policymakers, at the level of national decision makers, historically we've had a much more, at least principled theory, and what I mean by that is that we'd see people saying, yes, it's important that the rule of law be upheld, yes, it's important that the rights of all people, whether they're in prison or not, be respected and protected, that sort of thing. And I think we've started to see this year with the policymakers deciding to do things like implement regimes, they actually use that term, regimes that are, thinly based on already arguable theory and research, and what I mean by that is that they're saying that research theory, learning theory, educational theory shows that people learn best when they have incentives to learn. Makes sense on one level that if you're, if there's something that you want to learn for a certain reason, then you generally have a greater motivation to do that. So, but using that kind of educational behavioral theories and research, and again, I use the research in quotes there, what they've done is said that because Canada is seen as the best in terms of prisons in the world, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But because Canada is seen as having the best prison systems in the world, and because the theory says that it's by incentives that people learn, there's nothing more to give prisoners, so what we should do is take it all away and make them earn it all back. So it's such a bastardization. I mean, if it would be a good Monty Python skit for those of a certain age who like Monty Python or remember Monty Python, not that it was always great humor, but, I mean, it's that kind of, you know, absolutely inane, you know, I can't even find the adequate words to describe how illogical and nonsensical it is, and yet that's at the very root, the basis of the changes that they're bringing in right now, which is to force everybody, whether they're a maximum security prisoner, whether they're someone with a mental or cognitive disability, whether they're someone who's had all kinds of other challenges, and for all kinds of other really important reasons are resisting their authority. One of the expectations is that they will have to leap through hoops, and can. So the idea of just doing your time no longer will apply if, in fact, they succeed in continuing with this kind of regime change. So that's one of the worst things I've seen this year. One of the best things I think we've had the privilege of being part of is they're a coalition of equality-seeking groups, women's groups, Aboriginal groups, and include groups like Amnesty International and some other non-Canadian international groups, non-Canada-based international groups like Human Rights Watch and Sisters Inside in Australia and the Coalition of Community Legal Centres in Australia have worked together to submit a series of briefs and submissions to the Canadian Human Rights Commission regarding the discrimination experienced by women serving terms of 2 years or more in Canada. And it's not just the submissions that when I say submissions, it doesn't quite describe the entire process of the resources that we were able to obtain and then really ensure went out to those with the lived experience, those with the on-the-ground expertise because of their lived experience and because of their alliance with other women inside and outside, that the whole process of that coalition developing was an incredible process and another example of what is possible when enough committed people are working together, or even when just a few committed people are working together. And so what we've seen is a coalition that lives on beyond just the submissions. I think we've got some excellent submissions, and people who want to have a look at them, they're on our website at www.elizabethfry.ca. But they're, in addition to the submissions, it's the entire process of that group coming together and really working on some issues. And so one of the things we're in the midst of right now is that a push to close the maximum security units that have been built in the women's prisons. That's another negative that's happened this year, but the positive is that this coalition of groups and a number of women inside are very, very keen to ensure that they continue to work to provide support on an individual basis, but also to work on the systemic issues. So I think those are, for me, a few of the low and highlights for 2003.
Now, you had mentioned that Canadian prisons are of the perception worldwide for having some of the best prisons. Can you talk about why you would disagree with such an assertion?
Well, it's not that I necessarily disagree that Canada may have some of the be perceived as having the best. The response is the best prison in the world is no prison. It would be my basic response. And so if, in fact, what we have is seen as the best in the world, then for me it's a very serious indictment of what's happening, not just in Canada, but worldwide. And I think many people agree that there isn't anywhere a prison that people would say, yeah, you know, let's just go sign up and go there because it's such a wonderful place. I mean, the reality is we hear things like, oh, the prisons are better than public housing, they're better than, the education is better than what's provided in our schools. And I'm not saying that that may not be true in individual cases. It may not even be, you know, untrue in a whole community. But that shouldn't be seen as something to be proud of. I mean, it's such an incredible indictment of our communities, of our regions, of our provinces, of our nation, of the, you know, what's happening globally, if that is in fact true. And I think in some cases it is true that people's, you know, access to food and housing, just to have a shelter, food, housing, even sometimes clothing and access to education may be better, medication, all of those sorts of things may be better in a prison setting. And our response is, I do know of nobody who, if they had other options, would ever choose prison as a place they'd want to go. It is true that we're increasingly hearing of people saying, well, I get fed better here, people care about me here. And I think, you know, it is horrifying to many people to hear that kind of commentary outside, because what it truly does point to is not that our prisons are great places, but that our communities are becoming more and more inhospitable to more and more people. And I think that's the shame that we should all carry, that the reality that some people can't get fed. And, you know, as you're experiencing in British Columbia, and as we're, you know, only, what, 3.5 months away from the last estimate I saw in the media, so in the mainstream media, so who knows what the real number is, was that 29,000 people are going to be cut off welfare in British Columbia come April 1st, 2004. I mean, if that is even remotely accurate, then we all know where they're going. The only system that can't say no to them is the criminal justice injustice system. And so we know that, you know, it's already our homelessness plan. It's already our plan for the cuts to health programs. I mean, a recent study coming out of the States, which, of course, we're racing to follow their policies these days, a recent study out of the States showed that there were more prisoners with mental health issues, more people in prison with mental health issues than there were in psychiatric or mental health facilities. I mean, to even imagine that reality is, you know, seems outrageous. It truly is the nightmare that many of us have feared that is starting to happen. And I think it's part of the reason, too, that more in the community are waking up to this, because people didn't expect to see the progressive trends of the past to deinstitutionalize people with mental and or cognitive disabilities, ending up with the evisceration of all those support programs and the cutting of any kind of housing, sheltered workshops, all of the supports that were set up initially. People didn't anticipate those being cut, and the result being that people would be reinstitutionalized. And if they did even anticipate more institutionalization, they certainly didn't anticipate it being in prisons. They probably would have contemplated this being back in some kind of mental health institution or some sort of supported living environment. I think it's fair to say that people weren't anticipating it would be the prisons that would be the only place that couldn't turn people away or couldn't say they were full. So I think those are some of the issues we're seeing, and that's part of the reason Canada is still seen as leading. But man, when you're leading and you're the worst of all possible alternatives, or the best of all possible bad alternatives, I don't think it makes you much of a leader. And, you know, I just having come back from working with and having the privilege of walking and working with a number of women in and out, and some men and some young people in Australia, one of the things that was most shocking is approaches that have, I think, pretty much been trashed in this country. Things like the use of some of the classification tools with women and youth that we're up here are saying, you know, I think it's pretty clear that most people are saying they're not applicable, they're not valid to be used, and it's not appropriate to be using them with women or young people. When I was in Australia, Canada's still peddling those. And so we're spending millions and millions of dollars in promotional activities to export and then make millions and millions, or probably more than that, dollars in getting other countries to buy the sometimes outdated, at best, That's probably the most benign and at worst, programs that have been and approaches that have barely been called into question in this country. So, for instance, the use of classification tools with women and with youth, when here as part of our human rights review, as part of even the Auditor General's review of corrections, so they're, of course, focused primarily on financial issues, but even they said the use of the classification tool needed to be severely questioned because it was very evident that it was resulting in a discriminatory application against particularly racialized women, especially Aboriginal women, and also against people with mental and or cognitive disabilities. So if that's being recognized in our country and yet we're still promoting it to be used with women and young people in other countries, you know, I think it's, it's not only unprincipled, it's, you know, outrageous and should, you know, a behavior that needs to be called into account and take, and the government needs to be taken to task about it.
How difficult is that as a prison activist, someone who has, you know, constantly been in a situation in which you're trying to bring public attention to something that's happening within side of Canada's prisons, which are public institutions? Like, how difficult is it to cultivate this sort of transparency that's necessary?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure that I don't feel it's very transparent at this time. So I think that would be a question I'd ask you and lots of others about that. You know, I think there's many of us who go and do this work, and part of the way we all do the work and do it, you know, keep trying to improve how we do it is obviously to have direct contact. An ongoing contact with those who, about whom we presume to speak, and ensuring that we're not just speaking for someone, but that we're actually are working in alliance, and that it's at least co-leadership. And my preference is that it's directed by those who are going to be most influenced. And so I think being able to walk with as much as possible, and I don't have any illusions about the difference in my privileges versus those who are in prison. But, you know, I talk sometimes about needing to always ensure that we're putting, if we're getting, paid to do this work, if we're getting, if we have the privilege of these positions, then we need to be always putting them at risk by challenging the status quo, or else we're not entitled to them, and others have said it more eloquently than me. But, you know, those are some of the challenges I think that we're facing. I think part of it is linking up and ensuring that we're sharing that information, that we're speaking out, and part of it is continuing to hold a mirror up to, you know, the Canadian public, for lack of a better term, both through mainstream media, public education. I think, you know, from my perspective, alternative media such as yours are far more interested in promoting the reality of what's happening than those who are funded by big business. And so in the context of capitalism, and in the context of, you know, the globalization of so many of our issues and the globalization of our economy and social policies to the detriment of most people in most parts of the world, I think the challenges are certainly increasing, but I think it's also creating an increased and heightened awareness of those who are increasingly finding themselves on the bottom and needing to rise up. So my hope is that we'll see, and, you know, not just my hope, my determination is that we have to see more people rising up and raising awareness. And I think for me, if there was ever any doubt, I hope there wasn't beforehand, but if there ever was any doubt in my mind about speaking out, the incidents at the prison for women in April 1994 certainly dashed all of that when you started to see how clearly and directly everybody who tried to speak with the women and make sure their voices came out of that prison were vilified along with them, including Madame Justice Arbour, who's now in the Supreme Court of Canada. I mean, the fact that she issued a report that was a stinging indictment of what corrections had been doing for many years, not just with women but with men, and talked about their lawlessness and their lack of respect for the rule of law. I mean, this is someone who came never having had involvement with the prisons before, looked at the issues of the individual issues, the issues particular to the incidents that had happened in and around April 1994 at the prison for women, and that's, of course, the incident where the women were stripped and shackled and by a male riot squad and were then left in segregation 8.5-9 months with for much of that time with none of the legal entitlements being respected, including things like no mattresses, being on concrete floor with inadequate coverage even for a period of that time, not even having access to hygiene products, not having access to anything else in their cell besides a security, so-called security gown, which is, of course, like a horse blanket, and another one on the floor. And that was after several days of being in a paper gown, shackled. So, you know, when she saw those individual incidents, but she also looked at systemically what happened when she, as a commissioner appointed by the Solicitor General of the country and the Minister of Justice sanctioning it as well, when she asked for material, how she was stonewalled, how she was prevented from getting material sometimes and at all, and sometimes until the 11th hour, it was clear to her that there were much broader and bigger systemic issues than just those that happening at the prison for women. And yet when she tried to, she did articulate them very well in her report, the response was an immediate attack on her, and that was both personal and aimed at her professionally. Fortunately, corrections didn't have much credibility in that respect, the individuals in corrections who are obviously feeding it, and we'll never know exactly. We have suspicions. We never know exactly who they are because, of course, they hid behind a veil of confidentiality. And so, we're informants. We're providing information. Now, when I provide information often to the media, the mainstream media, I'm told that I need to back it up and there needs to be someone else who can attest to it. The reality is not the same when it's someone calling from corrections generally. My guess is they take it all pretty much as gospel. And so, so I think there's all kinds of things like that. But for me, it was that whole experience of a couple of years of dealing with just that incident and watching that even a someone who was headed for, she wasn't on the Supreme Court of Canada then, obviously, but someone in the position that Louise Arbour was could be vilified and attacked and attempts to discredit. And it became very clear that we all have to continue to speak out and speak loudly and often and as clearly and directly as we can, make sure that the picture of what's happening inside is, if not directly shown through things like the video that was released, then at least indirectly the picture is painted very clearly for the rest of the public.
Given that need for continuous action, maybe we can talk about 2004 and project in terms of what you've seen happen in the last 20 years of your experience in working within prisons. Where do you see the institution itself going, given the concerns that you've raised of events that have happened in the last year?
Where do I see it going? Well, I don't see it getting much better very quickly. And I think that the area that I personally and organizationally we're focusing on is looking more to the future of really building the impetus for a Canada without prisons. And I know that, given what I've said, that must sound incredibly naive and perhaps a little too idealistic. But I think the reality is that we're seeing more and more people are questioning what happens. And I think as April 1st, 2004 and beyond unfolds in provinces like British Columbia, we've already seen the sorts of ravages that the Harris and the Conservative governments in Ontario have created in terms of the death of Kim Rogers and the welfare ban and on so many people, and it's a misnomer really to call it a welfare ban because it's all social services, And similarly, the sort of situation that's going to unfold in British Columbia and other places in the country, I think will alert people in a way that we haven't seen them alerted before. I think that the Human Rights Commission will issue its special report about the violations, the discrimination experienced by women prisoners, and they will likely have some recommendations. The Public Accounts Committee nationally has already asked corrections to account for why they haven't developed an appropriate classification scheme for women, why they have women in men's segregated maximum security units in men's prisons, and on. So clearly what we're seeing is, even in the mainstream, people are waking up to that. And internationally, we've seen fairly conservative bodies like the Howard League in Britain, which is primarily academics, lawyers, judges, have come out with this past year a call for the end of any kind of incarceration for young people. And that comes after years of looking at trying to do reform and really re-envision how they could incarcerate kids in a way that was less destructive. And this body, which is, as I say, fairly conservative, has come out with a recommendation to decarcerate all young people on the basis that prison, what they say is prison for young people is at best benign, but in most cases is a brutalizing experience that has long-lasting and lifelong, deleterious or destructive results. And so I think when you see those kinds of bodies saying that, when you see places like the United States starting to get rid of some mandatory minimum sentences because they recognize that they're now paying more for jails and more for criminalizing people than they are for education, social services, health care combined, then people start to get, obviously, concerned, because when you're putting someone in jail for stealing a piece of pizza, as one of the most popularized or common examples people know about and talk about in the States, and clearly it's got problems. And I think Angela Davis's new book, which she just published this past, in the past year, Are Prisons Obsolete?, does an excellent job of looking at the comparisons between the types of arguments being made against getting rid of slavery to those that are currently being made against getting rid of prisons. And so I think, increasingly we're seeing more and more people realizing that prisons were an experiment. It's an experiment that's failed, and that it's very clear that we need to be looking at some new options in terms of how we deal with ensuring that people have what they need in order to live and contribute and be part of our collectivity, whatever kind of communities we define ourselves as, and that we need to ensure that we shouldn't have to criminalize people so that they can get adequate shelter, food and clothing, and any access to medical or educational services. So, those sorts of realizations, I think, are becoming clearer and clearer to people. And I'm finding that even in communities where people will describe them as very conservative, I've yet to find a group of people. Now, obviously, some would say, and I think appropriately so, that those who might come to listen or talk or be part of an event may already be the converted. But I recently had an experience in Calgary where, a businessman came just because he thought the title was provocative. The title was Prisons, Canada's Answer to Homelessness, Poverty, and Mental Illness, I think it was. And so he'd come just because he was interested in what was going to be discussed, and had a lot of challenging questions, and in the end came away with, not necessarily my analysis, but basically that it was a big waste of money to be pumping all this resources into prisons when, in fact, it ends up costing more to keep people in jail than it does to provide them with all of those services in the community, and then they could also be contributing. So, even those who ascribe to more or less progressive, I guess, ideas or less principled ideas about what's of value, and certainly those who privilege financial cost over human cost even, are coming to the conclusion that we need to be looking at some fundamentally different approaches. Otherwise, you know, it's a never-ending sinkhole, really, that we're just keep throwing more and more people in, and the finances that follow in terms of having to imprison in ever more isolated, ever more restricted, ever more static types of security settings. So we're seeing more and more bars, more and more cement, more, you know, now we've got prisons that are completely underground in some areas. I mean, it's just hideous to think what we're doing to human beings, and hideous to think of what we're doing also to our communities, again, however people define those. And then in the context of, you know, seemingly no concern for the environment, no concern for the broader issues, no concern for the impact all of this is having, how the entire prison industrial complex is skewing all kinds of, everything, all our lives in so many different ways. And I recently was talking to someone who couldn't understand why I didn't like the idea of crime prevention. And, you know, why don't you want to prevent crime? He said, I said, well, it's not that I don't want to, that I am against, obviously, preventing crime, but why is it that we see feeding pregnant moms? Why is it that we see having child care or, you know, Head Start programs or early intervention for young people or any of those sorts of approaches? Why is it we see those as crime prevention? Think of the lens we're seeing it through. It means that to say it's crime prevention means we're intervening only because we think those individuals might otherwise be future criminals, quote unquote, or that they may be spawning future criminals. And I, you know, not to be too blunt or sound disrespectful to the individuals, that's not my intention at all. But the reality is that people who are thinking of any of those activities as crime prevention already have a construct that I think is problematic. Why don't we instead have a construct that says every person in our community is entitled to be fed, to be clothed, to be housed, to have opportunities to learn, opportunities to contribute in whatever way they are able and choose to? You know, those are fundamentally different values than saying we're going to feed, you know, give breakfast programs or feed pregnant teens or provide medical attention to them because it's, you know, we're engaged in crime prevention activities. So, you know, I think we have to fundamentally rethink a lot of how we even describe some of what of the work we all do, and I include myself in that category.
In some ways, it sounds like you're talking about a bigger picture of a movement for human rights and a movement for social justice. Can you talk about the history of the prison movements that we've seen come out of the 1970s? Whenever you began working as a prison activist, working on the inside, working within our communities, building networks and coalitions, currently serving as an executive director at the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, where are prison abolitionists within the fight for social justice in Canada today? Where are they within that movement? Is it on the front lines, or is it a sideline issue for now?
I think it's both, depending on who it is. I mean, I think we're seeing increasing numbers of people on the in policy areas who will quietly say, yeah, you're right, I don't think we should have prisons either, but won't publicly state it. I think we're the only nationally organized coalition of, quote, criminal justice groups that are clearly clearly state and are abolitionists in orientation. I think that there are a number of women's groups and other groups, Aboriginal groups, and other formations of people who have organized, chosen to organize in a, you know, a sort of a group or an organizational structure, who express abolitionist views or attitudes, even if they don't clearly say that they're a prison abolitionist. And then there are countless individuals. One of the challenges, of course, is we just had this discussion with a number of co-activists in and women in prison in Australia, because I've been That's the most recent conversation with women in prison, just because I just got back yesterday morning. But when we were having some of the discussions, a number of the women who were inside said, oh, no, they believed in prison. And so, you know, as we talked about that, what's clear is, like so many of, and I count myself here, because when I started doing this work, I didn't consider myself abolitionist. I was a working class kid who had been raised with some pretty basic attitudes about, you know, taking care of each other, but also that if you did the crime, you did the time, and you just sort of, you know, as many people who don't have any notion that they may ever have any power or any of the privileges that go along with that power to change. Too often we accept that the position we're in is the position we're going to continue to be in, as opposed to having the supports and resources around us and our own privileges to recognize that we need to be able to not just be stepping up and stepping on the heads of those who we've been with, but to also be making sure that we're linked with and keeping pulling out and pulling up those individuals who are similarly positioned as we are or were. And so I think that our job is also, and I say job in the sense of part of our responsibility, is to ensure that we're sharing the information that we're able to glean through the privilege of our positions or of our education and those sorts of things. So in this context, when we're having this discussion in Australia, we started to talk about what it would mean if, in fact, a couple of the women said, well, we need to protect people. And what became clear is that they really didn't mean prison at all, that in the way that prison existed, that we all want to ensure that, you know, our kids are safe, that that they're, you know, people aren't being, you know, harmed in physical and non-physical ways and all of those sorts of things, and that really the protection of property is not the biggest interest for many people, especially obviously those who have the least property, but that the privileging of people over things is a pretty widely held value, not everywhere, but pretty widely held value, and that what the women in this particular group are in agreed in the as we were discussing was that what they really wanted to ensure is that those who are committing monstrous acts against people that are incredibly violating in terms of people being raped and murdered and those sorts of areas, the ones that are also the the horror stories that are pulled out by the right when they want to counter any kind of progressive challenges, that it's those very individuals are the ones that we need to be thinking of less brutalizing ways to address what's happening in, while also ensuring that they can't continue to be part of committing any kinds of monstrous acts, and that the best place to do that generally isn't in a prison, where all of those values of having power over and having the ability to control are in fact reinforced as opposed to interfered with. And so, I think that, it's those sorts of walks and, discussion and the actions as well that often are creating some of the largest impetus. And I think we, especially here, we don't have to look too far back to remember that it was, the general strike and the rising up of those who were being most depressed in the 20s, 30s that led to us having any kind of social safety net for any period of time. And so it's that kind of rising up that I think we're starting to see. And I hope it's not just my wishful thinking, but I think we are starting to see people have had enough. I think part of the challenge is that unlike the 20s and 30s and 40s, we have there are many people on the top who think we have that structure still in place and don't understand or don't want to understand or don't or are ignoring or are choosing to perpetrate the lies and or myths that in fact we still have a strong social safety net in this country, or a series of programs and services for people And I think part of the challenge is trying to figure out how do we ensure that those individuals also have the mirror held up to them in a way that they can feel it. And, you know, we're working or talking to and with some of the folks in South Africa who are similarly facing this challenge around apartheid. You know, as one of the women working on some of these issues there was telling me recently that, you know, one of the great challenges is after the so-called fall of apartheid, many of the people who had been activists against apartheid ended up becoming the bureaucrats that they're presently working with or challenging. And so the notion that there's an ongoing system of apartheid in South Africa doesn't communicate well to people who think that they've brought it down. And so, you know, we're facing, I think, some of the same sorts of challenges when we're, you know, it's much clearer if you have a system of apartheid that it's in policies and legislation, as it was in South Africa before, you know, the 1992. And similarly here, it's more easy to say we don't have adequate social services when there were none, as opposed to now talking about adequacy and appropriateness and relevance and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, there's some challenges. But I think there are, to finally answer, after a long way around your question, I think that what we're seeing now is that in the 60s and 70s, now 60s, I don't, you know, in any way pretend that I was part of the process, but in the 60s, what I know of those people who were involved, many people talk about that they were doing, you know, a lot of consciousness raising. They were working with and walking with people, and I think in some ways we're revisiting some of those sorts of strategies, but at the same time, I think we're linked much more into the broader systemic issues and the global context in which we're all working. And so, you know, many of us are talking about decarceration as strategies. Many of us are talking about making sure our work is not just happening in isolation, that we are linked into other social movements and environmental movements. You know, the fact that we had a crisis around water and power over the last few years in this province should not be seen as in isolation or not linked to some of the same crises we're facing in social services, and the whole notion of, you know, of privatizing and regulating all of these areas is directly linked to the human costs that we're seeing in all kinds of areas. So I think that kind of work is happening on both individual levels. People are, you know, aware and working on it. And I think there's challenges happening where people are recognizing that their co-activists or allies aren't aware of some of those issues. I often hear people challenging each other. I mean, I have some worries when I go into universities these days. I think that maybe it always was this way, but I'd like to think that we'll see we'll need more funding in public education and in post-secondary education. But when I go into universities these days, I tend to see a lot more really privileged young people, and I think it's increasingly difficult for people to access education if they don't have sufficient resources. And I think those are some of the challenges we will face, because the reality is that the values get passed on in so many different ways. And, you know, there used to be, and when I started doing this work, about 15 years ago, talking to a fellow who was working in Holland, and I was amazed to hear that prisoners had the right to escape in Holland. They don't anymore. It was wiped out in the early 90s. But the reason, the rationale was very much that, you know, it's counter any kind of human impulse to want to be confined, to be caged. And so, of course, people will want to leave. And if they do, well, we'll monitor. They'll likely get picked up again. And so it was a very, you know, common sense, logical approach. But there's no sense putting anybody at danger, that individual or anybody else, by trying to stop them if they really, you know, just can't take it anymore and I've got to get out. And so, I mean, now people would, you know, if when I mention that, often people, you know, think I'm joking. But the reality is that was a context. And in asking, you know, how that came to be in Holland, I mean, there were all kinds of speculations, but one of them was that, you know, a lot of the people going through being trained in universities and colleges were being trained by people who had lived the ravages of World War II, particularly the human ravages, and had a strong social value and saw the importance of humanity and humane responses to everything over financial or other kinds of perhaps more power-based approaches. And so they talked about the fact that in universities, many of the people teaching were and within, you know, most of the spheres of influence, there were people who had directly experienced things like the Holocaust, things like having their entire community invaded and all of them being essentially under house arrest. Those sorts of experiences, of course, lived with people and informed their work, their attitudes, their lives. And so, you know, we're also seeing that evolving out of lots of places. But, you know, my hope is that we'll see a resurgence of that as well. So I think where we've been, and you know, some of us used to talk about a lot of the folks doing prison work as, you know, doing hand-holding, charitable sorts of approaches, and I think some of that's true, but I think there's also an increased focus on ensuring that that we're looking at a much bigger picture, that we're not just focusing on the individuals in the moment, that we're providing that leg up or that reaching that hand in to help extricate people from the system on a one, you know, on an individualized basis. But we're also looking at the systemic issues that are causing increased numbers of people to be thrown into and treated as though they're being discarded into the criminal justice or injustice system. So, you know, we just had our 25th anniversary. As I've said, we, in many places, we haven't done a big celebration because, quite frankly, most of us would like to not exist another 25 years from now, because if we've truly been successful, there'll be all kinds of other ways that we can be contributing to our sisters and brothers and our communities, and hopefully that won't be through trying to get them out of prison. We can, you know, be looking at much more creative ways of contributing and participating in our respective and self-selected communities than by sticking, you know, doing this work because we're part of the prison industrial complex.
Kim Pate, I want to thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to have more information about the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, which Kim is the executive director of, if you'd like to assist them in their work, you can reach them several ways. One is by web at www.elizabethfry.ca. That's Elizabeth, FRY.ca. Elizabeth Fry, all one word, .ca. And you can also reach them by phone at 613-238-2422.
And we take collect calls from prisoners, and we have a 1-800 number. It's 1-800-637-4606.
Kim, thanks again so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you.